You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Claire Carolyn. She's in London, and we're going to be talking about her curatorial practice. Claire, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, it's great to be talking to you.
So, Claire, I know you do some independent projects and you're also curating at the Imperial War Museum. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what you're currently doing at the museum and what's happening at that particular museum.
Well, first, just to clarify the point, I'm not actually curating there. I'm involved as a researcher, and my research is contributing to an exhibition which is planned to take place there in 2017. It's a major exhibition about the representation of conflict in contemporary art since 9/11.
In the War Museum, your research is having, I mean, it sounds like a curatorial type research. You're looking at artists or you're looking at the history of what happened since 9/11 in terms of contemporary visual artists' response to conflict?
Yeah, what I'm looking at is the role of the museum within this kind of broader picture of the relationship between contemporary art and conflict. So the Imperial War Museum has had since the early 1970s a commissioning program working with contemporary artists, and the first commissions were with artists who were sent to Northern Ireland. So it grew out of a concern about how the Troubles, the ethno-nationalist conflict in Northern Ireland, which lasted from the late 1970s until the Good Friday Agreements towards the end of the 90s, were being represented and understood, and what artists could, what the role of artists was in terms of representing conflict. Going further back, the museum grew out of a series of commissions by what was then effectively a kind of arm of the British government, the propaganda, the Office of Information, it was called. And during the First World War, they began commissioning artists, they obviously weren't called contemporary artists then, but they were living artists, to go into combat zones and live alongside the armed forces and document what was happening there, but also to document what was happening on the home front. And then this process was reiterated again in the Second World War. So there's a long history connected with that institution of working with artists and including the reflections of artists on war in their collections. What I'm doing at the moment is looking particularly specifically at how that relationship operates in the contemporary time frame, if you like, and also related to that, just exactly what the contemporary time frame is, what it means, what this category of the contemporary is, and what it is in relation to conflict.
That's really interesting, because it seems that there's two areas there, or as I'm thinking about it, two areas. There's the kind of journalistic, almost reporting of war by having artists there next to reporters, or kind of embedded within the troops, and then there's which I suppose also has its own interpretations. Obviously, it's an artist's point of view, and then there's work, which maybe goes all the way back to Goya, or who knows, where artists are somehow depicting perhaps the horrors of war, or the conflict of war, or maybe the triumphs of war. That's just coming to my mind, but are those two separate categories, and are you looking at both of those categories?
Do you mean the journalistic and the sort of celebratory? Are those the two categories that you're
the journalistic and then the purely kind of interpretive. There's, as I understand what you were just saying, it's you're researching kind of journalists who are with artists, or artist journalists who are kind of reporting on the war, as opposed to or along with artists who are also responding to the war in whatever way that is.
Independently,
in other words, artists who are responding independently and are not in the war zone or the war scene. You know, plenty of artists responded to 9/11 and were never there.
Sure. I think these are precisely the kinds of, you know, the questions and categories that I'm interested in unpacking and trying to understand better. So what does it mean, for example, for an artist who would have experienced 9/11 through the media to respond to 9/11? What does it mean for an artist to be embedded with troops and go to Afghanistan to respond to that situation? And, you know, within all of these, you know, all within those two different sort of types of reflection, there are kind of distinctions to be drawn again. So, for example, there's a British artist called Mark Neville who went to Afghanistan. He was embedded with troops, and he returned and has made a work about that experience, focusing very much on post-traumatic stress disorder, which he experienced being there, working alongside British troops in a combat situation. There are other artists who were also embedded with troops, but who had much briefer sort of, I don't want to use the word tour of duty, but that's because that's something that applies to soldiers, but who spent much shorter times there and whose relationship with the environment and the combat situation was more kind of ameliorated. And an example of that would be the artists Adam Breenberg and Oliver Channerin, who made a work called The Day That Nobody Died, but who I understand spent a much shorter amount of time with British troops in Afghanistan. So in terms of kind of tours of duty or embeddedness with troops, there are very different kinds of experiences. And those are sometimes, you know, simply the results of chance. So another example would be Steve McQueen, who was commissioned by the Imperial War Museum to go to Iraq and make a piece about the war in Iraq. But he actually had to be brought back because the situation was too dangerous for him to remain there. Eventually the result of his commission was a shortish film piece, which was shown in Robert Storr's Venice Biennial, I think in 2007, which is called Unexploded, which is a film work depicting an unexploded bomb in Basra and the damage which the unexploded bomb had done to the building in which it had landed. And eventually, because he wasn't able to develop that work further, he chose to work with the families of British servicemen who had unfortunately been killed in action. And he worked with them he asked them to select photos of the families, to select photos of the relatives who had deceased. And the objective was to make these into postage stamps, which would go into circulation in the British postal system. The British Postal Service to date still hasn't agreed to do that. But the work exists as a kind of archival sort of filing cabinet, and it's toured around the country and is now in the collection of the Imperial War Museum.
Well, that's very interesting. And, you know, I mean, some of the artists you mentioned are directly addressing the conflict in some ways. Are there also are you looking at artists who don't address it directly? I mean, I'm thinking, and this may be a little outside the realm, but, you know, Monet painting water lilies as his kind of war painting or a celebration that war was over, or even reading, remember when Arthur Danta was reviewing it, a Whitney Biennial shortly after 9/11 and was talking about artists who were painting sailboats and that was as much a kind of response to 9/11 as anything else, because they're trying to find some kind of comfort and peace in a very kind of chaotic situation. Is that part of what you would consider addressing conflict or no?
I think it's certainly, I think that, you know, the broader picture is definitely, you know, the broader picture as in the broader art world is definitely the area where I want to locate my research. And I think it's absolutely true to say that in the wake of 9/11, there's been, on the one hand, a very sort of direct engagement with the subject of war and conflict within the mainstream, and particularly in, you know, on the biennial circuit. Whereas on the other hand, there's been a kind of retreat into the decorative and, you know, as you say, what did Matisse say, that he wanted art to be like a comfortable chair that you relaxed into after a hard day at work. So there's definitely, there is definitely a sort of drawing back, you know, an extreme drawing back into subjects which are apparently far removed from this. But I guess in terms of research, it's hard to quantify that. Where those subjects are or what the intentionality of those artists is.
That's true, because I think when Arthur Danto was talking about it, he was interpreting that. He wasn't, the woman who made the sailboats weren't necessarily in reaction to 9/11, but since this was so soon after 9/11, he mm-hmm. was looking at everything in that context, that all mm-hmm. the art mm-hmm. that's made in New York now by artists is in response to 9/11, whether they think so or not. It's made, you know, in what was a traumatized city then, so in a sense it has to be, but perhaps that's generalizing it too much, or certainly for the way you're talking about the museum.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think what you're highlighting for me is a very interesting question, is that the exhibition, the starting off point for the exhibition is 9/11. The experience of 9/11 in New York City was obviously something quite different to the experience of 9/11 in London or in many other parts of the world. I think what you've just done is highlighted something that I need to pay more careful attention to. Maybe I think the other, but to go back to your question about kind of retreat from the actual representation of conflict or, you know, specific overt engagement with it, there's certainly a tendency that I've observed among artists in the UK to engage with the subject of war in a kind of, esoteric sort of way. So an interest in conspiracy theory and connections between the military and the occult and magic and so forth. And artists like, for example, Bonnie Camplin, Suzanne Triester, they're working very much in this sort of area. And that's an area which is kind of, I wouldn't, when I began the research, have thought that this was something that was necessarily falling within the sort of camp of what I wanted to look at. But it's increasingly starting to look like defined kind of constellation of responses of a particular type to the subject, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. It's very interesting. I know you're also working on other projects, other independent projects. Can you tell me a little bit more about what else you're doing at this time, or things that are happening outside the museum that you're involved in, either research-wise or in a curatorial role?
Sure. Well, I'll mention two projects. One of them is an exhibition which actually took place a year ago at an independent artist-run space in London called The Function Room. This was an exhibition of two series of works produced collaboratively by the artist Stuart Holm and the photographer Chris Dawley Brown. On Friday, this Friday in London, we're launching the catalogue which accompanied that exhibition. The exhibition is based around a series of photos which Stuart Holm inherited at the point when he traced his birth family. He was adopted in later life discovered the identity of his biological mother, and at that point inherited a collection of photographs which had belonged to her during her lifetime, many of which depicted her working as a model during the 1960s and various other episodes from her life, including traveling on the hippie trail in the 60s. And what Holm decided to do with a set of these photos, which were a professional standard portfolio shot by a photographer from the 1960s called Carla Hopkins, was to restage them with himself in the poses of his mother. So at this time, Holm was 42 years old, and in the original photos, his mother is, I think, 22. So he assumes those poses. They were shot by Chris Dawley Brown, who's a photographer who for many years has been working with digital morphing processes and is very concerned with the effects of time on people and places and buildings. And what Dawley Brown then did with these two sets of photographs was morph them together using a program called Phantomorph, so that what you see in each individual image is an aggregate of Holm's mother at the age of 22 modeling and Holm himself as a 42-year-old man assuming her postures.
Wow.
Hello? Yeah.
Fascinating, fascinating. And so this will result in a book, obviously, and will there also be an exhibition, or the exhibition has already happened, and it's only a book work?
The exhibition has already happened. There was also, that was the first series, and that series was actually completed, I think, in 2004, and then 10 years later, Holm and Dawley Brown decided to revisit the series, but this time to repose the reposing of the photographs, if you see what I mean. So the motivation for the second series was an interest in anti-aging technologies and you know, this sort of 21st century obsession with youth and so forth. And because they were both by this time in their 50s, it was a kind of experiment in digital cosmetic surgery, if you like. I mean, this is a sort of facetious way of describing it, but it was also a continuation of the original project. But in the second series, there's no trace of the original photos of Holm's mother. It's just Holm 10 years ago, Holm currently, 10 years later, and those two sets of images then morph together. So what we did with the exhibition was show each picture. I think there are 10 in total. Show each picture next to its pair, if you will. So those pictures were composed of three separate images.
It's fascinating. I love that project, and it does seem so really tapping into something that's going on. I mean, your phrase, which maybe was off the cuff, a kind of digital know, cosmetic surgery that you said seems appropriate. There's now apps that do that. I mean, besides being obsessed with anti-aging techniques, drugs, surgery, there's apps that, you know, can just, you know, as they call them, one's called Facetune, that literally just kind of tunes up your face so it looks a little different or more the way you want it to look, you know.
Okay.
Kind of amazing how obsessed as a culture we become with that.
Yeah. Also a sense that these, you know, this was something that really began in the 1960s, which was the time when Holmes' mother, whose name was Julia Callan Thompson, started modeling. So this sort of, complete obsession with youth and pursuit of youth for by cosmetics companies and so forth for profit was something that really kind of took hold in the 60s and that she was kind of exploited by this system as a very, very young woman.
Sure. It's very interesting. I'd love to see that when it's done. Is there, it's been wonderful talking to you. Is there any other projects that you are working now that, I mean, that's certainly plenty. It seems like you're very busy, but is there anything else I should mention that you're working on now before we close?
Well, just to say that the catalog for the Age of Anti-Aging is available online. It's published by Vargas. And it contains all the images I've spoken about. I'm also working on a publication for the Museum of Contemporary Art and Design in Manila, which is a reflection on an exhibition that I curated there a year ago called The Surface of the World, Architecture and the Moving Image. And that was an international group show of work by 12 different artists who all reflect on the built environment using the moving image, but in very, very different ways. And so we'll be bringing out a publication shortly, which we're going to make available online so that it can be accessed from anywhere in the world, really. I mean, that was one of the, you know, one of the sort of concerns and challenges and interests of working with this museum in Manila was how to have a conversation sort of across cultures and across space about a subject which was, which is affecting a great many people living in urban environments, which is the transformation of urban space and how that is recorded.
That sounds fascinating.
Through
the moving image in particular, you're saying,
because
this had a cinematic element of how, and I interrupted you there, so I'm just asking to articulate that, because it was through the moving image was the lens of that particular exhibition?
That's right. I mean, it really grew out of a concern with, you know, I suppose, film and architecture and the relationship between film and architecture, and it then kind of expanded really to consider the built environment more broadly and the moving image and its, you know, different kinds of different manifestations.
Claire, it's been wonderful talking to you. There'll be links in the interview so people can also find the books you've mentioned. I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, Claire.
It's really a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.